This is Fintan Dunn reporting. We've got a great interview for you tonight with Daniel Hopsicker, one of the world's leading 9/11 researchers. Dan has got some new information. He's connecting the dots in the 9/11 issue down in Florida, and his information is dynamite. He became internationally famous initially when he released details of the relationship between Mohammed Atta and his girlfriend Amanda Keller, Mohammed Atta's party lifestyle, and his seeming connections to cocaine trafficking, his easy access and great fondness for cocaine. That's just the tip of the iceberg in a series of perhaps 30 articles, giving us an increasingly detailed picture of what was going on down in Florida and who's behind it all. And in his latest information on the internet, he's detailing connections between the 9/11 hijackers, the German individuals who seem to be recruiting and or sending people from Germany to Florida for flight training, and the Charlotte County Airport, because it's out of Charlotte County Airport that Frank Moss, famous through his Iran-Contra connections, is operating, and a number of others who seem to be connected to the flight schools which were used by those 9/11 terrorists. Flight schools, which Hopsicker's excellent reports revealed, are connected to the CIA. So, what do you get if you connect an international covert network together with the 9/11 terrorists, the flight schools, Huffman Aviation, Rudy Deckers, Barry Seal, the Charlotte County Airport? Well, I tell you what you get. You get a load of connections to drug trafficking, you get a load of connections to dirty international business which involves terrorism, and you get a picture of something going on in Florida that's very like the information that Sibel Edmonds has been revealing or attempting to reveal in her disclosures about what was going on inside the FBI. Now, if you'd like to follow along with this material as we discuss with Dan Hopsicker, go to his website, madcowprod.com. That's madcowprod.com. And you'll find the article we're discussing is on the homepage right now, Thursday, 12th of August. If you want to check it out and you're listening to this show later, then just go to the previous articles page and look for an article there which has got the title Terror Suspect Tied to Moroccan Military Attaché. Oh yeah, I forgot to mention that as well. He's connecting all of this back in to a military attaché working for the Moroccan embassy in the United States. It's riveting stuff. Who's got connections to those hijackers? Who's connected to those flight schools where they trained? This is where we get specific. I'll be straight back with Daniel Hopsicker. You're on the inside track on breakfornews.com. I always know when you've got really good information because you start getting very funny, Dan. You can see it in the writing.
Well, at a certain point, you know, it's hit me in the face so hard and so often that the only response, okay, is an ironic detachment. And if I'm lucky, get to point out that the emperor's wearing no clothes. Because what we're talking about is the official story of what happened on September 11th.
Mm-hmm.
And the government's story, what we've been told, it does not match the facts.
Yep.
The picture of why the government has not told us the truth is now coming slightly into focus.
Mm-hmm. It's coming into focus in specific detail, which is good.
That's correct.
What do you think of the latest evidence that the aliens were involved, Dan? To me, it's mounting evidence now of clear alien involvement.
Well, with each step closer towards the truth of who was collaborating with Mohammed Atta and his people while they were here, the fabrications about what might have happened September 11th grow wilder, don't they? It was just a missile hit the Pentagon.
Yeah.
And then shortly it was the planes were flown by remote control. And then it moved to there weren't any planes. It's all a hologram. It's ridiculous, but somebody's tax dollars is paying, at least for the seeding of it. Then what you need to realize, and I hate to be you know, the one to rain on your parade, is that the so-called dissident media is every bit as much as controlled as the major media is.
My parade was washed out years ago, Dan. But maybe we're raining on some listeners' parades. And yeah, get a reality check, guys. This is the politics of bought opposition. It's so old that it's got cobwebs on it, and that's exactly what they're doing in this case. It's disappointing, but then that's why you're listening to this interview with Dan Hopsicker on breakfornews.com, because nobody's bought us off. Nobody pays our checks. which is why we're so poor.
Well, and that's something else that I have had to address at every step along the way here. I've had to find a way to write and publish books without benefit of a major publisher.
So let's get to the meat of some of the stuff that you've uncovered and which you have got on your website, Mad Cow Prod, that's madcowprod.com. And it's headlined, Terror Suspect Tied to Moroccan Military Attaché. And it starts off with a quotation from an interview we did with Sabelle Edmonds on breakfornews.com, where she says, "There are certain points where you have your drug-related activities combined with money laundering and information laundering converging with your terrorist activities." But there's a whole lot more to just the Moroccan angle in your story, Dan. You've nailed
it. Well, yeah. It's hard to know where to start. It's an embarrassment of riches. It turns out that the terror watch list that the FBI never released it, okay? The FBI distributed its terrorist watch list to law enforcement agencies around the world,
mm-hmm.
friendly law enforcement agencies, presumably. And the Finns, in a burst of democracy, made it public. So we all got to see who the FBI thought the terrorists were.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And the interesting thing about that is if you look at the terrorist watch list, the only address for the alias that's listed there of Mohammed Atta is in France.
Mm-hmm.
And if you read Welcome to Terrorland, you'll hear Amanda Keller, Atta's one-time American girlfriend, telling me that the story he told her was that he was French.
Mm-hmm.
And she believed him. Now, she wasn't the sharpest knife in the drawer, but he did speak French.
Yeah.
And he also told her an anecdote that I have puzzled over for 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
He listened, Mohammed Atta listened to the Beastie Boys nonstop while he lived with her, to the point where one day she destroyed his CDs. And in the argument that ensued, he told her that why he listened to the Beastie Boys so much was that the Beastie Boys was his 9-year-old son's favorite band. He told her he had a 9-year-old son
right.
in France. Now, it certainly seems obvious to me that Mohammed Atta must have had a number of different legends or cover stories he could slip in and out of
mm-hmm.
as circumstances warranted. But to go to the length of explaining why he liked the Beastie Boys so much, that explanation somehow has a ring of truth to it to me.
Mm.
I mean, it's one level beyond what would have been necessary for the cover story.
So what do you figure?
That's my feeling. I bet we could track down a girlfriend and child of Mohammed Atta in France somewhere, unless they've left that country.
We don't know quite where he was. We know he was working for a German-American cooperation group. We know that he was in Germany. But we've got some nicely painted pictures of him sitting alone in his room in Germany and being a very sort of introspective and withdrawn type of guy.
Well, what struck me was while I was in Hamburg with Matthias Bruckers, a German writer, I took advantage of his ability to speak German
mm-hmm.
And went and interviewed the owner of Planktonor, I can't say it right. It's an architectural firm where Otto worked part-time for a couple of years doing architectural drawings.
Yeah.
And he described Otto as being the best draftsman they'd ever had there because he was so meticulous in detail.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, he was the kind of guy who could happily sit for 8 hours doing a drawing of the side of a building.
Mm-hmm.
So he obviously had the ability to, like, draw up into himself.
What year would that have been that you're talking about then?
93, 94, 95.
Yeah. I agree with you. That paints a picture of a certain type of mentality and a certain type of mental focus. A lot different picture than the guy who has uncontrollable violent outbursts we've seen from the Mohammed Atta Florida version 7 years later. What caused
right.
that transition?
Well, that's the arc of a drug trafficker, is it not? I mean,
mm-hmm.
hasn't everybody seen the movie Scarface?
Well, yeah.
With Al Pacino? Al Pacino doesn't, you know, start out nuts. You know, he ends up nuts. Mm-hmm. And you know, that's what cocaine does to you. I mean, you know, those of us who lived through the 80s have some vague memory of somebody near us doing cocaine once or twice. And over time, it sort of affects your reasoning ability a little bit, I believe. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, sure it does. Sure it does. And also produces the kind of symptoms we've seen in him, which is rampant egoism and often violent as well. That around the same time that he was showing up in Florida at Huffman Aviation, there was also something happening with an Irish connection. And I'll give you the correct pronunciation. This TITIM Holdings, TITIM, is how you would pronounce that in Irish.
Here we've got the Gaelic source at hand. What does that mean in Irish?
Well, in Irish, ectitum would be falling, and titum is to fall. So, yeah, you've got it right. It means to fall down, to fall over. And it's quite a curious connection. I'm really puzzled.
Three Arab men, one of whom is the chief military attaché for the Moroccan embassy in Washington, D.C., founded a company in Florida before 9/11 called Falling Down, Inc. This is scary, my friend.
Mm-hmm. In what sense?
It's scary because we here that live in the United States are well aware that we're about to be attacked again. And we are not able to trust our own security service. I wouldn't trust the FBI as far as I could throw them.
Yeah, well, that's been made pretty clear. Sybelle Edmonds did a great letter to Thomas Keane, where she points out that none of the stuff that she talked about in those congressional hearings and that she detailed in her evidence, it's all still in place. The same people are still there. The same operational procedures are still there. And we know what happened with those operational procedures last time we had a problem. They scrubbed the information so it didn't go through the system.
Let me talk about Sybelle Edmonds for a moment. I just saw her 60 Minutes. First of all, I was unaware of her, basically, until I went to Washington, D.C. a couple months ago and heard her story and went, oh, my God, you know, she's talking about the same thing I was seeing in Florida.
Yeah.
I just recently saw her 60 Minutes interview, and she is just eminently believable.
Yeah.
She's telling the truth.
Yeah.
And what she has to say dovetails with what I found in Florida. I mean, the story I just wrote is about Muhammad Atta at the Charlotte County Airport. And the reason it ended up there is, of course, and it gets a little complicated, but let me run through it for you and your audience once. The chief military attaché at the Moroccan Embassy in Washington, D.C., founded Falling Down, Inc., with a guy on the terrorist watch list, Muhammad Arara. And this guy, Muhammad Arara, is hanging out with and giving as his home address on three separate occasions addresses owned by Pascal Schreier and his wife, Sandra Hamuda. Now, who the hell are Pascal Schreier and Sandra Hamuda? Pascal Schreier is a German spy. There's no other way of putting it.
Mm-hmm.
He's been in this country doing God knows what for God knows how long, but certainly with the knowledge and blessing of the U.S. government, unless they're far more incompetent than we even think.
Well, yeah, one of the stories has him arriving in the USA in 2000 to get married down in Florida.
There was obviously a German operation in place in Southwest Florida going back to 1996.
Well, Pascal Schreier is someone who is described also as a realtor who specializes in inward investment into the United States, people wishing to buy property in the United States, particularly...
Right, but mm-hmm. For the purposes of our discussion, for your audience that doesn't know, Pascal Schreier was the chief recruiter for the two Dutch-owned flight schools in Venice, Florida, that trained dozens and dozens and dozens and dozens of terrorist pilots. For if the FBI ever came out with the real number of suspected terrorists that Rudy Dekkers trained, the number... I think would be in three figures.
Yeah, and that information which you detailed in some of your earlier reports out of Florida mentioned this German and didn't name him at that time, a mysterious German who was associated with Muhammad Atta, and now you have named that individual as Pascal Schreier.
Correct, and he's married to a half French, half Tunisian woman,
mm-hmm.
Sandra Hamuda, whose father is a parts manufacturer for Boeing.
Mm-hmm.
He's in commercial aircraft. Strangely enough, Pascal Schreier's father manufactures windshields for commercial aircraft in Germany.
Right.
Why would that be at all of interest except just coincidence? Well, when Pakistan arrested that key individual over there a couple weeks ago, it turned out he worked for Pakistani International Airlines,
right,
which is owned by a Saudi prince,
mm-hmm,
one of the chief Saudi princes, and one suspected through in ways that you know, I'm not the person to tell you about, of involvement in the September 11th attack.
Okay. Pascal Schreier, right. So you would regard Schreier as a recruiter, getting the students across there to Florida,
and
organizing
absolutely.
The flight schools.
And they even advertised a mentor program.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it looks a lot like an intelligence operation.
Yeah, I was going to say, where do you think the money came from to do all this?
Recruiting for what is the question? Yeah, absolutely.
Mm.
Recruiting for what is the question? And remember the first place, or the second place, that Atta and Marwan went before they went to Huffman Aviation was a flight school in Norman, Oklahoma, of all places,
mm-hmm,
which had a long history, even at that point in the year 2000, of training pilots for Osama bin Laden.
Right.
So that tells you that all flight schools are not equal, that terrorists are not as likely to show up, you know, at any of the 220 flight schools in Florida, for example. No, they're going to go to one or two because those are the one or two participating in a covert operation which we know nothing about.
What do you suspect, or have you any ideas about what... It seems that that operation is a lot bigger than just a 9/11 issue. Why were they training that level, that number of pilots at these schools?
Well, actually, that... I just read that in a book. I can't believe it.
Mm.
Bob Woodward has written two books since 9/11,
mm-hmm,
famous American reporter. And in, I believe, the first of the two books, whose name escapes me at the moment, casually in chapter one... Casually, he reveals, and this is the only place I'd ever read this, that beginning in July of 2001, the U.S. began to insert Special Forces A-teams into Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm.
Bush had signed, President Bush, my President Bush, had signed a presidential directive to destabilize the Afghan regime.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, we, meaning the U.S., was going to war with Afghanistan, but going to war with Afghanistan the way we normally go to war, which is in a covert fashion.
Yeah.
A little bit at a time.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, when I read that, I went, my God, why wasn't this known? Why didn't I know this? I like to think of a well-informed person, and I had not heard that. I mean, I had heard about all of the intrigue about the oil pipeline and talk that was, you know, and somehow important to the attack, but I had never read that the United States had decided to take hostile action towards Afghanistan before September 11th.
Mm-hmm.
Does that explain anything to you?
Yeah, well, that would give a motivation, all right.
But then, of course, the big question becomes, what's the big secret? I try to be a reporter, and I did not have any really overarching theory of what happened on 9/11. I wanted to know who Muhammad Atta's neighbors were.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I wanted to know if he stayed out late at night. I wanted to know who he hung out with. And through that, I learned, for example, and I thought this was important, that seven of his closest associates, people he went to meetings with during the last year of his life in Florida, weren't Arab, but were German or Swiss, and in one case French. That is significant in any real investigation into what the hell happened and who did it to us. So why hasn't my government come forth with an honest investigation? And the answer has got to be what Sybil Edmonds is talking about.
Yeah.
That these are the boys. And they're here.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when I look up and I look around, I go to Charlotte County Airport. I mean, we're talking Frank Moss and Dietrich Reinhardt, two of the most famous, infamous, actually, Iran-Contra operatives, operated at the Charlotte County Airport.
Yeah.
A tiny rural airport. The sheriff's department there has lost 23 helicopters. There's 23 missing helicopters. You know, well, they know where they are. I mean, I kind of make a joke about it, but I explained it in an earlier story. Those helicopters get disappeared through a U.S. government program whereby surplus military materiel is made available to local law enforcement agencies,
mm-hmm,
for their use.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Charlotte County certainly doesn't need more than, it only has one city. So I imagine one helicopter would do, or two if they want to fly in formation. If they've lost 23, it's because they were being funneled through the Charlotte County Sheriff's Department to other people for other reasons. And in that program, already airplanes have turned up with, for instance, a missing C-130 turned up on a runway in Mexico City with $1 billion worth of cocaine on it.
Right. Now, we were discussing Pascal Schreier and what that shows us about a covert operation which was running about the flight training, and these guys been brought in, been part of that covert operation, having an Afghanistan connection. But then this same bunch of people are linking right up with what I call Iran-Contra Reloaded. You know, last time it was only the Southern Hemisphere, this time it's the world. And those connections all come through the Charlotte County Airport.
Yeah, and the two things really mesh.
Mm-hmm.
Why I got into what I'm doing today is because at a certain point, I was in my 40s,
mm-hmm.
which was a shock all by itself, and I realized that none of the major events that had occurred in my country in my lifetime made any sense to me.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know who killed Kennedy. I don't know what Watergate was about. Iran-Contra never really broke as a scandal.
Mm-hmm.
None of this, and the big thing was I never knew why we were in Vietnam. I mean, I was an anti-war protester. My dad and I battled for 10 years, and bless his soul, he's dead now. But if you turned to him in a quiet moment, you know, over a beer, and said, "Well, what was that all about?" He couldn't tell you.
Mm-hmm.
What I'm leading up to is, I believe I know today now what the Vietnam War was about, and it wasn't about Vietnam at all.
Right.
It was about Laos. Boy, it was about the Golden Triangle.
Yeah.
What happened in the Vietnam War is the United States CIA supplanted French intelligence in the heroin-producing Golden Triangle region, and we wrested control of the worldwide heroin trade from French intelligence and their Corsican allies, and the CIA ran things in the Golden Triangle, and mobsters, American mobsters like Santos Trafficante, sold the stuff when it got to the States.
I'd agree with you that's when it all went wrong.
Let's pretend for a moment that everything we know is wrong, okay?
Right.
Let's pretend that we're not brighter than the people at the CIA. What if there's truth to the idea that who controls the international narcotics trade controls the world?
Right.
Okay? Because
it's the biggest chunk of off-budget money that there is in the world.
Because after spending 2.5 years in Florida, the comment that rings the most true was from a Special Forces commander at MacDill Air Force Base, who in an offhand way told me that we were going to war in Afghanistan because the Taliban were attempting to supplant the Cali cartel. We're attempting to use the leverage they had by being the dominant supplier of heroin in the world to move into the cocaine trade and then take it over.
Right.
So at the time, I think there is a self-serving element in that explanation, but I think the part of that explanation that really sticks out as ringing true to me is this a drug war?
Right.
Which is to say that it is a war, because all war is economic.
Mm-hmm.
And if the international trade in illegal narcotics is a significant component of world trade, and it is, fighting for control of that would be tantamount to fighting for control of the world.
Mm-hmm. Based on that approach to things, what would you then see as the motivation, the real reason that we went into Afghanistan?
You be the Medellin cartel and I'll be the Cali cartel, okay? Well, there's two ways we can operate, okay? You and I can get together and divide the trade,
mm-hmm.
and operate quietly, or we can go to war with each other.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they went to war with each other because the Cali cartel was the government of Colombia and the Medellin cartel wasn't.
Yeah.
Okay? So if, just speaking metaphorically now, understand.
Yeah.
If the Bush cartel and the Bin Laden cartel couldn't get along, they might go to war against each other.
Right.
And, you know, I can't tell you that that's the case. I suspect it is. And let me tell you, honestly, if that is the case, I don't have a dog in that hunt.
Right.
Except the Bin Laden cartel killed 3,000 people just like me, and that pissed me off. It's parochial, but they say all politics is local. This happened here.
Yeah.
I am responsible to my community, the people in my community,
mm-hmm.
To the dead people, to those dead people, to find out at least what happened. That seems apparent. I mean, at least to me.
you know, some of the reports we get out of Afghanistan are dubious and manufactured, I believe. We have gotten indications that the poppy crop was seriously down in Afghanistan prior to the U.S. going in, and that now it's back on full-scale production.
It's not that simple, and I don't believe that that's true.
Mm-hmm.
When I was researching Welcome to Terrorland, the only resources I relied on were, book-wise, were things that had been published before 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
And in that context, there was a book called Reaping the Whirlwind that I believe is pretty well respected in Europe.
Yeah.
And in that book, see, because Mike Rupert over here has been nattering on about Mullah Omar getting out of the opium trade.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the ridiculous thing about that notion is that people that think George Bush is lying with his every breath, which may well be true, somehow develop like this complete naivete when it comes to Mullah Omar. Mullah Omar wasn't going to get out of the opium trade. When the Taliban took over his home province, Helmand province, doubled in heroin immediately in pot opium cultivation.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact of the matter, according to Reap the Whirlwind, and their sources were Amnesty International in a 96 report, and the UN in its 2000 report, which included satellite images, was that in the year 2000, when Mullah Omar offered to give up the opium, at the same time he was offering to get out of the opium growing business, cultivation of opium in Afghanistan increased by 50% in that 1 year.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, that's why I've always been a little bit reluctant to just believe what's been coming out, that, yeah, the poppy crop is back in because the Americans are in there. And before the Americans went into Afghanistan, it was way down.
I believe it is undeniably true that it is larger now than it ever has been.
Mm.
I believe in the year 2000, you know, or 2001, when the events we were talking about took place, Afghanistan was responsible for over half of the world's heroin. I believe that figure today is two-thirds to three-quarters.
Yeah, it has gone up, but the picture that was painted is that prior to the invasion, when the Taliban were in power, a fraction of what it had been. And that's the part I don't buy.
Why would people put that story out, do you think?
Yeah, good question.
Would it be maybe so that no one would ask questions about... See, there's been a lot of talk about negotiations taking place between the U.S. government and the Taliban regarding a pipeline across Afghanistan.
Yeah, seen
that. But I haven't heard a lot of talk... any talk at all, except between you and I, about trade negotiations taking place having to do with heroin.
Yep.
And very likely, the idea that Mullah Omar was getting out of opium production is designed to keep us from asking, did heroin get mentioned in those trade negotiations, Mr. President?
It's the great unspoken. It truly is the great unspoken. And that's why you'll have to start asking questions as to how far up the political military establishment, which is only inches away from this drug network, I mean, how far up that establishment does this thing go? Who are the real mafia bosses?
Actually, the real question is how far down.
Yeah.
Because you would have to assume that it starts at the top, okay? A successful drug cartel, according to Miami's leading private detective, needs four things: production, distribution, transportation, and protection.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if I'm the sheriff of Charlotte County and you want to sell drugs in my county or bring in drugs, I can provide you some protection, but I can't keep the FBI away from you, can I? It would start right at the top. It would start right in the president's office, especially when you have a president, as we have had, and the reason why we may never again have a president in the United States who wasn't a southern governor first,
mm-hmm.
is because it's the southern tier of states that's been most clearly corrupted,
mm-hmm.
by the drug trade.
I would assume, as you say, that you don't run this kind of stuff unless you have that top-level participation. In terms of the administrative structure, it must be all horribly, horribly compromised by this point in time. Involvement in the drug trade for reasons of geostrategy etc., etc., and we might as well be in there to stop the bad guys being in there. And anyway, it's all a dirty, messy business. And look, don't worry about that coke coming in there. That's okay, because it's part of an operation that we're, you know, it's got political dimensions to it. And it's perfect cover then. All of your drug smuggling gets swept under this cover of politics.
But, and just as you're saying that, I'm realizing something. And what I just realized is that the reason it has become increasingly difficult for them to cloak their participation in the narcotics industry is because they used to be able to give the excuse that we were fighting communism.
That's right.
Okay? And it had a certain respectability. But now, we're not fighting anyone. Well, maybe we're fighting the world's first Islamic drug cartel. But my government doesn't want us to know that.
Right. Put it this way, whatever system has gone down has to be sold to relatively straightforward, sometimes God-fearing individuals who are, you know, ordinary middle-class, upper-middle-class people. And you've got to sell that to them with some kind of a philosophy. And the philosophy of political utilitarianism is the reason why we look the other way in terms of certain drug shipments. It's a perfect cover, because it lets everybody feel that, you know, it's okay to let this go on, because the world is a dirty place and you have to play dirty sometimes. But it's a perfect cover for the fact that the political utilitarianism is way secondary to the primary thing, which is making a whole heap of money out of the drugs and getting power using that.
And consolidating power.
Mm-hmm.
Because, and I don't want to get wacky here, I mean, there are certain thoughts out there, strains of thought, that one doesn't pay attention to, except to know that they're there. And I've been hearing for 10-15 years about natterings about something called the New World Order.
Yeah.
And I think I see it here now. I know I see it. When a military undercover guy at the Venice airport tells me that when he checked into Rudy Decker's, he was told to leave it alone because Decker's is bigger than national. He's transnational.
Mm-hmm.
And when we see German operatives, Arab operatives operating, you're looking at the workings of a larger invisible entity.
Mm-hmm. There is a place where various vested interests coincide.
Exactly. What matters is if we can get out the simple fact that during the same month that Atta and his crew arrived to go to his school, the owner of Huffman Aviation had his Learjet confiscated, seized when they found and found with 43 pounds of heroin on board.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, any prosecutor would make the connection. Any self-respecting journalist can make that connection.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, the connections. I mean, that you've detailed them in the incredible stories that you've written over the last few years out of Florida.
And I've had absolutely no effect. I was down in Naples last week. I saw Rudy Decker's down there. He looks tan and fit, I am sorry to report.
You know, I'm glad to hear he's gotten over that little incident he had where the helicopter went down into the estuary. And
I think someone was reminding him who was in charge. That's a great way to do it. I think he became real humble real quick after that, you know?
That'll get your attention any day.
I think family became more important to him.
As they say in the business.
His wife divorced him. That's one good piece of news. Who, by all accounts, was a nice lady. I really won't say anything more about that. But he not only is still there, he's prospering. The Federal Aeronautics Administration here is probably one of the most compromised organizations the Earth has ever seen.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But they still, someone forced them to, come down civilly on Rudy Decker's and Wally Hilliard for flying 23 unauthorized, illegal charter flights in the year 1999 and 2000 to destinations unknown and with passengers unknown.
Mm-hmm.
My information says he was flying Saudi princes around.
Right. Yeah, well, there's... But I would say that you said there you have had no effect. I know that that's a perception that's easy to get there in the USA, Dan. You've had an effect internationally outside the USA, and you are having an effect in the USA. Yes, I will agree that we are witnessing one of the most well-funded covert deception programs rolled out, and it's all over the 9/11 dissident movement. And it's well-funded, and it's a clever plan, and it's going to drown us out, they think, with loads of garbage, which will obscure the true investigations. I just wanted to reassure you that you are having an effect, and you can see the tracks of that effect. If you look at what Sibel Edmonds is saying, how closely it dovetails with what you're talking about, how that's been picked up by Michael Meacher, the acceptable face of conspiracy theory in Great Britain, and he's not talking about aliens being involved or holograms. He's talking about Pakistan connection. He's talking about Sibel Edmonds' information. He's clearly aware of your material as well. And then in response to that, Dan, you have an article appearing a couple of days after the Meacher article on Pakistan Online. And it's a big rubbish article on Meacher. It says, you know, this is complete nonsense what Meacher's going on about. So that article coming out is a sign to me that you don't put an article out like that unless you're aware you've got to counter this stuff coming out of Meacher, which is coming out of Sibel Edmonds, which is coming out of Dan Hopsicker. So, you know, you are having an effect.
Right. I'm providing employment for, you know, maybe half a dozen, like, covert propaganda specialists.
Exactly. Exactly, yeah.
I believe, and I told you this before, we all need to do what we find inside of us to make the world a better place.
Yeah.
And that could be, you know, that could mean, you know, on picking up trash, you know, in your own town, you know, whatever it is, right?
Yeah.
For some reason, this is mine. And I've been attempting to learn the truth and then learn pieces of the truth, at least, and then to pass them on.
Yeah.
God, I have a lot more about the drugs, too. I mean, that was just a terribly long article I put up there, and I left out all the best stuff. I guess I'll have to save that for the next one. But there's some amazing stuff there. I'm going to tell you about, there's a guy. You're familiar now with Rudy Dekkers. This is wonderful that I have had an effect. Now you know who Rudy Dekkers is, and you know what a shady flight school owner he was. Well, there's another guy that was just like Rudy Dekkers on the other side of Florida, but there was nobody, like, you know, drumming on him like I've been drumming on Dekkers. He's a guy who participated in an inside robbery, an inside job, in Belgium in 1981, where they stole from Sabena Airlines shipment $5 or $6 million worth of gold, Krugerrands, and diamonds.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, because a security guard was murdered in this heist, this individual was convicted in absentia in Belgium and sentenced to death. So what this guy did was join the U.S. Army, Special Forces. and go on to an illustrious career in South Florida as a drug trafficker.
Right.
This is all true. And the point of the story is that this guy has 9/11 relevance because it was his flight school in Lantana, Florida, that Otta made at least a half a dozen unexplained flights from in the last month before 9/11.
That's right.
This guy was living under his own name. He never tried to hide.
Yeah.
Because being connected means never having to say you're sorry. But apparently he ticked off someone who came over from his native Belgium in 1999, and that someone he ticked off had him arrested.
Mm-hmm.
And he was extradited from Miami to Belgium, supposedly to face, what do they do, hang people in Belgium? You know, the guy has nine lives because less than a year later he was back in Miami. And that's a true story.
That's called getting away with murder.
Yeah, well, I mean, and Barry Seal was the first one I came across. Barry Seal, I wrote Barry and the Boys, CIA Mob, and America's Secret History. I became aware that if you are what the mob calls a good earner,
mm-hmm.
you can wriggle out of almost anything.
And, of course, even if you do get sentenced and convicted and thrown in the slammer, who's to say you're still there? That game is played as well.
You know, we don't even want to go there.
Yeah, we don't want to go there.
Because you don't want to know
who isn't in their cell right now.
Or their coffin.
Yeah.
Timothy McVeigh.
For example.
I don't believe Timothy McVeigh is dead.
Yeah.
And the reason I don't believe he's dead is because there was no autopsy performed.
Yeah.
Even though an autopsy is a federal law in a case where the government put someone to death, and the coroner complained.
And you know, it's weird, but I don't even believe that that's the real Saddam Hussein they have there in Baghdad. Don't know where I got hold of that idea. Maybe it's the fact that we've never seen him in the flesh, despite all of this. So, yeah, things are not as they appear on so many levels. But one thing I'd like to come back to, because you were discussing it earlier on in the interview, and that was the issue of this military involvement and covert involvement in the drugs trade. Looking at the size of the drug trade, it's huge, it's liquid money, it's intensely profitable.
One of the and there were two things that happened recently that I was going to touch on, just to show how the elite of the individual societies around the world control the drug trade in their own country. Mm-hmm. The son of the Prime Minister of Canada owns a steamship line where they found 85 kilos of cocaine stuck under one of his ships a couple weeks ago.
Right.
You know, obviously that was just a mistake. Saudi Sheikh, whose name escapes me at the moment, who had a 727 that landed at Bourget Airport outside Paris a couple years ago, and it was discovered to have an ungodly amount of cocaine on board. I think we're talking, you know, half tons or something. So it is obviously the elite in each of our individual societies that rakes off its cut before the drugs make it down to us.
Yeah.
Or to those poor, unfortunate individuals.
Well, if you take that then, if you take that as the background, you've also got a lot of money in the military, and that's and big profits there as well too. And what I'm wondering is where this shift and when this shift, the shift from the military-industrial complex to the drug-military corporate-industrial complex that we've got now took place. And I suspect it's back around the Kennedy era when the drug money started to become as important as the military money become as important.
Well, certainly heroin began flooding the U.S. in the late 60s.
Yeah.
And drugs have been an integral fact of American life since then. I'll tell you an anecdote, just a brief one, that kind of explains this. A friend of mine who spent his career in intelligence, he's an old guy, he's a nice old guy, brought a guy to meet me one time wearing a trench coat. Can you believe this guy was wearing, it was raining, but he was wearing a trench coat. And this guy, who was an imposing figure in his late 50s, was introduced to me as the special advisor to the president of a large Midwestern institution.
Right.
So I showed him like a half an hour or so of my first documentary, The Secret Heartbeat of America, back when I had like decent budgets to work on. And then I waited because I thought the guy was just going to come right for my throat, okay?
Mm-hmm.
How dare you? How dare you? You know, no, he didn't do that. Like, everybody knows government smuggles drugs. He said, I've loaded drugs onto planes. I was just in Costa Rica. It's still going on there. He said, what's the big deal?
Yeah.
Well, I said, you know, everybody doesn't know, you know, because if everybody knew, drugs would be legal, you know, and those 2 million poor schmucks in America who are in prison for, you know, selling small amounts of drugs would get out, you know? Don't they have moms that, like, you know, whose hearts are broken about their, you know, if I went to prison, my mom's heart would be broken, you know? I mean, those guys' moms' hearts are broken, too.
Yeah.
And I said, and I looked at this guy, and it was so stupid of me. I looked at him, and I said, and if it's no big deal, I'll tell you what. I said, put me in charge of cocaine distribution in North America next year, and I'll choose your next commander-in-chief.
Oh, how true. Well, there is this perfect intersection between the profits from the drug business, the debilitating effect of mass availability of hard drugs in the USA, particularly in communities who might be the same color skin as you, and then that you can set up the whole prison industrial complex, and then you can bar the felons from voting again. And so the whole political control machinations just dovetail beautifully with the drug business, and that must have vectored the thing right up to the top levels of political control really fast.
And if you look at just recent American history, the mob came to power in America during Prohibition.
Exactly, and that was only a short period of time.
Exactly. Yeah. And drugs, I mean, the drug prohibition is obviously the same thing, but it's been going on for a lot longer time.
And our thanks to Daniel Hopsicker. That's it for tonight. We've got another guest lined up for you for tomorrow, focusing on another aspect of the 9/11 story, and I think you're going to find that equally interesting. I'll be back with that guest, and even then, we're not finished. We're going to be focusing on the issue next week. Heck, we haven't even started. What we're trying to bring you here is the leading edge of the 9/11 investigation. For breakfornews.com, this has been Fintan Dunn reporting.